are talking about insurance companies, and in December, we all watched as the horrific murder happened of the United Healthcare executive in New York, and I can't say it strongly enough that nothing justifies a cold-blooded murder that was committed to an innocent person. So that is an interesting thing that happened, though, as a result, was this conversation about insurance companies denying claims really opened up. And if you looked at social media, I just know that even my friends and my lawyer friends all have a story about some necessary procedure or medicine or surgery that they needed or their family's members needed, and they were denied. And there's a lot of anger and frustration. And so I wanted to discuss this with somebody who knows about it from a firsthand perspective. I want to talk about, what do you do if you're denied health insurance coverage for something that's medically necessary in your view? And what can we do from a legislative standpoint to make sure that insurance companies who provide these contracts are making good on their contracts, and that there are ramifications if they don't? And with us is Joel Feldman. He's here in studio today. He's the founder and president of Cover My Health, a nonprofit here in the Chicago area supporting patients and their families to overcome insurance company obstacles for people seeking treatment for mental health care. Welcome to the show, Joe. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Karen.
First, I want to talk a little bit about, this is a fairly new organization that you started, and I want to just briefly touch on what provoked you to get into this world, because you're not an attorney and you're not a healthcare person necessarily, but you're a person who had some personal experience with this.
Right. So I first got involved in this some years ago. Our daughter, early in her high school days, required some treatment beyond what we could provide for her at home, and her psychiatrist recommended that she be in a residential program. And so we took the steps to organize that. And not long after she arrived at this residential program, I got a call from her therapist. And the therapist said, you know, I'm going to have a call later today with a psychiatrist who is working for your health insurance company. And around here, we call him Dr. No. And the result of this call is he's going to say that there's no more medically necessary treatment and that your daughter has to leave the program. So I didn't make any sense to me at all. And later she called me and said, well, we had exactly that conversation. And what I knew is that that determination was wrong, that the care was in fact medically necessary. And although our insurance company was standing in the way of saying they'd pay the claims, that we would be able to dip into our savings and cover it, essentially go after the insurance company later, which we did in a successful federal lawsuit where the judge concluded that in fact the care was medically necessary and the insurance company got it wrong.
And one of the things, and I don't want to get too deep into it, but the question is, you know, when you bring these lawsuits, it's not like you're going to necessarily get paid attorney's fees, so that you might have to pay out of pocket to have an attorney bring this litigation. And at the end of it, you could win, but you could be out of pocket for a lot of money in the litigation, which, in my view, maybe health insurers know that instinctively, and they know a person in your situation is going to get that care and maybe not bring the lawsuit because they can't afford it.
Well, and this is in large part what drove me to start this company, Cover My Mental Health, because litigation can be the right way to go, but it's extremely unusual that it's sensible for the reasons that you talked about and some others. And so what we try to do is provide people with, first of all, encouragement that we can level the playing field with the health insurer, and also resources that they can use today that don't involve litigation, steps that they can take even ahead of a formal appeal that will enforce that a health insurance company should pay for the care that's medically necessary.
And I want to get to that. And we're also, just so you know, I'm going to say this a couple of times, we're going to post on the WGN website in the podcast segment of this interview a link to a really nice, it's a one-page summary on how to deal with insurance carriers who may be denying your coverage or you're trying to seek coverage. And I think it's a great explanation, and we're definitely going to post that. So you'll go to WGN Radio KarenConti.com. You'll go to the Karen Conti Show and you'll see this interview with Joe Feldman, and you can click on and get that. You said something interesting to me when you arrived at the studio today, Joe. You were talking about this tragic murder of the executive for UnitedHealthcare, and you said there was another insurance issue that occurred the same week that was very prominent in the insurance community. Can you tell our listeners about this? Because I didn't know about it.
Sure. So Anthem Health is one of the largest health insurance companies in the country. And the same week as that tragic shooting, Anthem backed down from a policy that they had been in the process of implementing, which specified how many minutes of anesthesia they would cover based on the type of surgery, which is to say, in advance of a surgery, they would say, these are the number of minutes that we will cover. And anything more than that is something that we'll discuss and we'll review later to see if it was actually medically necessary. So you could imagine that that didn't make sense to very many people at all.
There's complications in the surgery and you need an extra 20 minutes and what, the patient's going to wake up while the scalpel is still being used.
Right. It creates a lot of just completely nonsensical scenarios.
Right.
Not the least of which is having an anesthesiologist thinking about the minutes when they really should be focused on the patients. So that same week, based on really significant pressure from the governor of the state of New York and the controller for the state of Connecticut and a number of others, they backed down and said they were going to withdraw that policy, that they were misunderstood, and that they would be reviewing it. But to my taste, we didn't misunderstand anything. It's just really simple. It was a reach to say we're going to try to pay less for anesthesia based on a methodology that just makes no sense to any adult who's paying attention.
This is a really basic question, and it's a big question, and it's a question for lawyers, it's a question for somebody like you who's an advocate. But what stops a health insurer from wrongfully denying claims? I mean, they have a contract with you. You buy a contract, right? And, you know, in my world, in my legal world, you make a promise and someone pays money for it and you make good on the promise or you can be sued. The problem is, as we just said, it could be cost ineffective to bring that lawsuit, especially when you're going through a medical issue and, you know, maybe it's a life or death situation and you have no time or money or energy to bring a lawsuit against a huge, you know, company. So are there any barriers for an insurance carrier to, you know, do the right thing?
So at the core of this, of your question, is who decides what care is medically necessary and on what basis do they decide? And you could say from the insurer's perspective, they might say, well, we're going to cover different care that's medically necessary. We just want to be really sure that it's medically necessary, and we want to make sure that the standards have been followed appropriately, and we want to make sure there's no fraud. So those are all statements that, I'll say, on the face, make sense. What doesn't make sense is when the insurance company denies claims without any particular basis at all and is basically waiting for the clinician or maybe the patient or maybe the family member to say, hey, wait a second, this care really is medically necessary and you need to pay. And when there's a time gap between the insurance company saying, no, we're not paying, we're going to say it's not medically necessary, and when care is needed, that in that gap is where danger certainly can happen.
And I had an interesting text from the 847 area code. A person can be charged with criminal child abuse for harming a child, and on and on. And, you know, that's an interesting thing. Could an insurance company be charged with that? I've not seen that yet. It's not to say that it hasn't happened. And I haven't really seen criminal charges against insurance companies, but you and I discussed this. There's such a thing as criminal fraud. If someone's going around promising something that they're not making good on, that can rise to the level certainly of a civil fraud, meaning you could bring a lawsuit and get damages for the breach of contract or the fraudulent misrepresentation. But what about the issue of criminal fraud? And, you know, have you thought long and hard about how to hold insurers liable? What are your bullet points, Joe, for what you'd like to see legislatively or systemically to make insurers do the right thing here?
So I think one of the most significant actions that could be taken and was taken in the state of Illinois last year is to require insurance companies to evaluate medical necessity based on generally accepted standards. So clinicians are trained as follows, and they're familiar to us as non-clinicians. Do no harm, use care that's safe and effective, apply generally accepted standards. Those are what people are taught in medical school and in clinical training. The idea of medical necessity is a legal concept. It's not a medical concept. And so there should be no gap between medical necessity and generally accepted standards. So last year, Governor Pritzker signed into law in the state of Illinois the Health Care Protection Act that mandates that insurance companies must apply generally accepted standards, the most recent ones, in making a determination about what's medically necessary.
So those are written somewhere that are readily available to people who are both in the insurance field and in the medical field.
So there are a wide range of different resources for generally recognized standards. The American Psychiatric Association has guidelines. American Substance Abuse, the ASAM manual describes a number of standards. LOCUS is another. So there are a wide range of different standards that can be applied and that should be applied when making a determination.
That sounds like a good start. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Joe Feldman. He is the founder and president of Cover My Mental Health, and we are going to give out some contact information and some information posted on the WGN website about how to go about getting your insurance claims covered, and we're going to talk about that next on the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN, and we're talking to Joe Feldman. He is the founder and president of Cover My Mental Health. It's a nonprofit here in the Chicago area, and they support patients and their families overcoming problems with insurance carriers and obstacles for people seeking treatment for mental health care. Let's get right to the idea of, I don't know anyone really who hasn't had an issue with coverage on health insurance issues. Tell our listeners some bullet points. You're going into getting some medical procedures and, you know, you want to make sure things are covered. Can you give our listeners some things to make sure that they know about? And then we're going to talk a little bit about what happens when an insurance claim is denied.
Sure. So Cover My Mental Health is particularly focused on areas where there's going to be a disagreement or a potential disagreement between a clinician and the insurance company. So I can say, thankfully, for many aspects of accessing care for mental health, like going to a therapist appointment or going to a psychiatrist appointment, those are covered and there's not really much of an occasion for disagreement. Where you get disagreements when you have changes in level of care, so say going from an outpatient scenario to intensive outpatient or to partial hospitalization or into residential care, depending on medications that might be indicated, the psychiatrist may prescribe one drug and the insurance company doesn't agree that that's the right one. Those are the areas where we think a medical necessity letter can make a big difference.
And tell us what that is.
So a medical necessity letter is a document that's signed by a clinician. It can be a psychiatrist, a psychotherapist, a frontline therapist, that says, here's my training, here's my experience and my practice, here's my specific experience with this patient and what needs they have, and then these are the generally accepted standards that I've applied in determining that the medically necessary care is XYZ.
And you should do that even though your claim hasn't been denied yet. You think that's always a good idea?
So I think it's certainly a good idea once a claim has been denied, but more and more clinicians that we're talking to are warming to the idea that this is something that can be provided preemptively in anticipation of a potential disagreement with an insurance company.
Okay, so you get that out before you're making the claim, before you're denied. Let's just say then you are denied and you feel like you're wrongfully denied. What are the steps that you should take as a patient or an advocate for a patient in disputing that denial?
So on our website is a downloadable template that provides a head start for a clinician to be able to provide a medical necessity letter. We also have a very brief transmittal that can be downloaded so that you can send this medical necessity letter signed by the clinician to the insurance company, essentially to put a marker down that says, this is the clinician who's making the decision and they've evaluated my care and they're in the best position to decide. Then it's really in the insurance company's court to say, no, we think there's been a mistake. And that's when you've already got yourself armed with what I like to call the secret weapon of a medical necessity letter.
And are there time deadlines usually to file these appeals?
So appeal has a very specific, means a very specific thing in this context. So the initial idea is provide this medical necessity letter and have the insurance company make their determination in writing. If they say it's not medically necessary, now you've got essentially a level playing field. You have the clinician who's got the experience with this kind of care and your care in particular, and the insurance company who doesn't. And that's where the first step that we suggest may be appropriate. And I should say this is in the case where it's not an emergency. Emergencies should be dealt with in a different manner. To say to the insurance company that we want to file a formal complaint, because that triggers a particular kind of review within the insurance company that's not an appeal, that essentially asks them to look at this case and see whether or not they are making the determination based on the correct quality of care. That's a good first step, even before filing a formal appeal.
And I, having been involved in some of these myself in prior jobs and situations, you know, it's really important to be organized here, right? I mean, people get very angry and very emotional, and I understand that. But my advice, you know, and you probably will agree, now's the time to be very methodical, to get that letter, to make sure it's as thorough as possible, to make sure that the doctor understands what the purpose of this letter is, and to be timely in giving these things, and to be firm, and not to be, a lot of people write letters that are very emotional and like all over the place, but to be just very clinical about these appeals.
That's exactly right. I've had a number of people say, you know, you really have to be aggressive and you have to be assertive and you have to speak to a supervisor. And as much as those might get the job done, I don't think those are necessarily teachable skills. I think what is teachable is this is a letter that can be used to establish the clinician's primacy in making the decision and provide that letter to the insurance company and essentially put the ball in their court to try to explain why the clinician who knows best got it wrong.
And let's just say you go through these procedures and you do your best here and there's still a denial. At what point do you say, I should hire an attorney? Is there a complaint process with the Department of Insurance? Is there a complaint process with the Attorney General's office? Is there anything else a person can do?
Sure. There are a few things that can be done. Certainly filing a complaint with the Department of Insurance is something that's available. That process takes time, and it may be more challenging than not in terms of urgency. I think another resource that is often overlooked is to reach out to your elected officials.
Mm.
We just posted on our website a short video from someone who works in the Texas legislature. I met her at a conference in El Paso a couple of months ago, and she was describing how she gets calls from constituents, and they say, I'm having trouble with my insurance company. Can you help me? And she said, we love to field these calls because we can help our constituents to cut through the morass. And I've also talked to people who are former insurance company executives, and they've said, that's a really tough call for us to get from Senator so-and-so's office saying, what is going on with this claim, and why are you standing in the way of medically necessary care for my constituent? So those are steps that are certainly available.
I would not have thought of that aspect, but that's a good one. And, you know, I'm wondering with the collective anger that I've seen in the last, you know, month about these types of issues, you know, why, and we talked a little bit about this, and maybe this is simplistic coming from my standpoint, but, you know, the Attorney General's office, you know, has a lot to do with consumer fraud in our state. And I think they do a very good job traditionally of addressing a lot of consumer fraud, whether it's for elders or for car sellers or in the environment or what have you. Why shouldn't there be a division in the Attorney General's office that is funded by our legislature that has lawyers in it who are savvy about healthcare and healthcare coverage, who can look and see who's denying coverage on a regular basis? What insurance companies are not making good on their promises or not following the medically necessary care that the that is being recommended? So. And then going after them, whether that is going after them civilly with punitive damages, whether that's going after them criminally, or at least making them aware that they're on the radar. Is that something that has ever been proposed to your knowledge?
So there are certainly resources within the Attorney General's office here in Illinois, and there are attorneys general across the country who are pursuing these actions. They are very challenging, and they take a lot of time,
yeah.
Right? So one of the most significant lawsuits in this area of mental health coverage was a case called Witt versus United Behavioral Health. It's been going on for 10 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a class action lawsuit. The guy who's the lead litigator on this is someone I've collaborated with quite a lot, and it takes a lot of time and resource to be successful with that. They reached a judgment against United Healthcare in that case, and now the case is in appeal. So the resources that we can provide to, let's say, an attorney general's office are laws that are clear and reporting mechanisms for compliance of those laws. And I do think for the state of Illinois, we're in a really good position for the long term of having this Healthcare Protection Act mandate the standards of care that must be followed by an insurance company. And soon, so that law is in effect as of January 1. So over time, more people will understand that that's the law. Clinicians will understand that that's the law. And slowly, slowly over time, we'll see how they're doing. And having the attorney general focusing on whether that's actually working or not is the foundation for pursuing a lawsuit that really matters.
Joe, thank you so much. We have real quick time here. Joe Feldman, he is the founder and president of, I'm going to get this name right, Cover My Health, Cover My Mental Health, a nonprofit here in Chicago. Give us your website that listeners can go to get information.
Sure. It's www.covermymentalhealth.org.
And we're going to post this little one-page sheet about how to deal with your mental health claims, and that's going to be on the WGN website. And is there any other resource that you can give our listeners?
So in addition to that that page, which I appreciate your posting on WGN, you'll find on our website tips for dealing with customer service reps at insurance companies. You'll also find information about what to do when you can't find a provider in your network and you're looking for help. So that's another resource that we have.
Thank you very much, Doug. So we're going to have you come back and follow up on this really fascinating topic.